wartime is often the time of desperation, but also innovation in that necessity is the mother kind of way. Throughout World War II, governments on both sides threw copious amounts of resources and money into creative efforts to outthink and outflank the opposition. Some of these ideas worked, many didn't. But author and journalist Leslie M.M. Bloom's recent Town and Country article takes these maneuvers to a whole new level. It hooked me right from the title. The Art of War: How the Surrealists Help Upend Camouflage and Redefine Modern Battle. In a globe-spanning investigation filled with big art world names like Gorky and Dali, her piece asks, and I believe answers, a simple yet powerful question. Can artists and creatives play a crucial role in times of conflict? From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. So I found this article fascinating, and it's something I had never really considered camouflage before. I had never thought about it. It hadn't crossed my mind that there was any kind of creativity or any thought beyond just the utilitarian usage of camouflage. Mm-hmm. So where did this seed get planted? How did you end up on this pathway towards talking about this topic?
Well, I mean, so I do a lot of historical research and reporting on war reporting. And so my entrance to this subject was through Lee Miller, the surrealist photographer Lee Miller. And I'd been reading, this was actually a few years ago, I was researching some project on her, I can't remember what. And I was reading some big book on her, and there was a picture of Lee Miller lying naked on what appeared to be a lawn, covered in some kind of green makeup and scraps of turf that were covering the bare, you know, the pits and parts of the body. And there was sort of this throwaway description, you know, this very casual description of like, oh, this is Lee Miller in camouflage. And her boyfriend at the time, Roland Penrose, a surrealist artist, British, happened to be spearheading a surrealist camouflage unit in the early days of World War II. And she was, you know, posing in camouflage makeup for him. And right away, I'm like, wait, what? A surrealist camouflage unit? How can somebody with my interests and predilections not know about this? I'm a huge fan of absurdity. Give me a Coen Brothers movie and I'm entertained for days. And so I kind of earmarked the subject. Go back and look at it. You know, go out and find out the intersection between surrealism and camouflage. And, you know, what was that surrealist unit really like? Was it absurd? Was Salvador Dali involved? I mean, who made it up? And what would it be like to do military camouflage with some of the most anti-establishment nonconformist artists of the first half of the 20th century? So that was really my entrance to the topic. And then, you know, I kept thinking about it and coming back to it. And I've been kind of nosing around. I was kicking the tires of it to see if it could be a possible book. So I've been researching it all last fall, like fall 2021. And, you know, ultimately I decided it was not a book. It was more of an article. The article became urgent to me in February with Russia's attack on Ukraine, because in essence, what my story is about, it's about civilians who are suddenly under the threat of a military invasion, and they were bringing every skill set that they had to battle that existential threat. And yes, they were surrealist artists. They weren't going to be that great with holding a gun, but these are people who were like, okay, well, what do we have to bring to the table? We have art. How can we apply that in this military environment? And so what they did is they fought fascism with art. They found a way to bring their particular absurd, surreal skill set and make it revolutionary within the military landscape. And it really did end up having an enormous effect in the early days of the war in terms of protecting Britain from Hitler's blitzkrieg, and eventually helped turn the tide of the war in North Africa through a massive surrealist campaign.
So, you know, this is not new territory. It seems like, having read a lot of your work, you've really been fascinated with the kind of intersection between the humanities and times of conflict, whether that's the Lost Generation, which you've covered a lot, or fallout, looking at, you know, Hiroshima and everything, you know, just the way these kind of disciplines bump up against each other a lot of times, the chaos of the world meets, you know, people in some ways maybe trying to make sense of it or help in some way that may not have the traditional tools that we think of. You know, these are not necessarily people going out to work with the Red Cross, but they're using whatever tools they have at their disposal. Why do you think you're constantly drawn to this? I'm just curious.
Yeah, you know, as you're talking, I'm like, wow, it really is always about the intersection of art and war. And, you know, whether it's applying art as a form of warfare or making sense of war after the fact, right? You know, so my first book was, you know, about Ernest Hemingway's Rise, and, you know, he, Through the Sun Also Rises. And, you know, in that, he's making sense of World War One, and he, you know, essentially defines the Lost Generation, you know, an entire generation of young people who are, you know, essentially what he thinks to be ruined by that first major global conflict of the 20th century. And then Fallout for me documented John Hersey, reporter John Hersey's, the backstory behind his reporting on six civilians who were in the Hiroshima bombing, and his reporting on that for the New Yorker, and how that changed, you know, the nuclear landscape and the nuclear policy landscape, you know, for 7.5 decades afterwards. You know, the surrealism story, it's about that again. I mean, it's about individuals, you know, these artists who are confronted with a massive global conflict. This is unbelievable, unavoidable nightmare, as one of them put it, and you can't avoid it. So how are you going to fit yourself into it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in this case, it wasn't documenting aftermath in the way that Hersey and Hemingway did, at least in the periods of time that I documented in my last books. But in this case, it was, you know, these individuals, in this very granular and applicable sort of way, again, are putting their skill set to help battle existential threat. And, you know, again, it just really hit a funny, it was always fascinating to me intellectually, but it did feel like a sort of a more eccentric historical topic until, you know, 6 weeks ago, when all of a sudden we're seeing all these civilians in Ukraine who, you know, like on the turn of a dime, they're not, you know, shopkeepers or physicians anymore. All of a sudden they're fully, you know, in their militaries, you know, and these are civilians who are making roadblocks, and they're doing anything that they can in their skill set to defend an existential threat. And it just, for me, brought a new urgency to the surrealist topic. And it, you know, for me, you know, war can be relayed in two different ways. You know, there's sort of the macro coverage of war, you know, the statistics, the number of civilian dead, the number of buildings destroyed, you know, campaigns told from a bird's eye view. But then there's also this very human and granular way of telling the stories of war and conflict. And for me, the most successful works of art that have really conveyed the true horrors and the true nature of war always come down to telling those sort of granular human stories. And I think that must be why I keep coming back to it again and again, because it's the only places where that kind of storytelling has success, because the other way is, it's essential, but it's also anesthetizing.
You know, I had been familiar with the concept of the ghost army, for those listening may not be familiar with this. This was kind of an initiative that was undertaken to create basically almost like set design components to kind of trick the enemy into thinking there were tanks that weren't actually there, and sound elements. So this was kind of bringing in people who were maybe from Hollywood or using those almost theatrical skills to build tanks that weren't real and all these things. Mm-hmm. That was kind of one discipline. And I had been familiar with that. There was a book about that. There was a documentary I'd seen about that. But this side of it, this kind of surrealist take on camouflage, like you said, you had not heard of it. I certainly had not heard of it. What I wonder about it is, at some point it became an official pursuit of some kind. And it's one thing to be Salvador Dali or Gorky or anybody else that says, hey, I'm an artist, I want to do this thing. How did they get from that point to having people actually thinking it was a good enough idea on the upper levels of whoever's making decisions to think that maybe we should try this? Was it just the chaos of the moment and let's throw anything against the wall and see what sticks and works? Do you think that's part of it? Or how did it kind of reach the level of, okay, here's some money or here's whatever resources you might need to go see if this thing actually works?
first of all, you know, some of the surrealists like Salvador Dali, you know, he's in America during World War II, and so is Gorky, and they're both obsessed with military application for surrealism, but they're really involved in the academic spheres of that. And you know, Dali, you know, he writes an article for Esquire talking about how, you know, the surrealists and Dali in particular have been long obsessed with the art of making things either, quote, disappear or seem like something that they are not at all. And both of those skill sets, you know, that he's arguing and Gorky are arguing, you know, they should be applied to have military applications. But I think in terms of getting it from that kind of academic position to actually getting a military budget acting on those ideas, it was really the British surrealists, because you know a lot of them stayed in the UK and they were on the ground during the Blitzkrieg. I mean, they felt at, you know, in the earliest years of the war, particularly in 1940, that invasion was not just probable but imminent at any moment. I mean, and so it was essential. It was like all hands on deck. Every idea really needed to be tried. And so the surrealists weren't just helping to create, you know, on the fly, revolutionary camouflage to help mask buildings and what they called pillbox structures that were anti-tank structures, you know, across the British Isles, you know, that they're starting to think about not only that defensive kind of camouflage, but they're thinking about, okay, how can we use camouflage to turn us from an underdog to a victor? And so, you know, camouflage wasn't, you know, entirely a new idea, but it was very rusty when World War II came about. So in World War I, there had been, you know, Cubist approaches called dazzle, used to help make ships, quote unquote, disappear or blend in with each other. It wasn't hugely successful, but it was still incorporated. So it wasn't that huge of a stretch for the military to then in turn entertain surrealist ideas in World War II for their camouflage designs. But it did take some doing. And Roland Penrose, again, this British surrealist, really was completely instrumental in getting the military top brass to pay attention and say, look, it's not just about defense, but let's throw money at this. Let's make this let's consider all the offense possibilities of camouflage. And as I talk about in my article, it ended up having very significant application in North Africa, in which an entire ghost army was created by British military forces to divert German forces there. So they created thousands of fake tanks and trucks and fake soldiers. And you know, when surveyed from the air, the Germans looked down and they saw, you know, this phantom army, this dummy army, and the Germans attacked it. And then in the meantime, it left them vulnerable to a counterattack from the British, and the British prevailed. It was a major victory for the British after the disasters of Dunkirk and Singapore, and they desperately needed the morale boost. Churchill was thrilled, you know, talked about the victory of camouflage in the desert. So when you're first coming into the subject, you're like, there's no way in hell that the military is ever going to like hear what Salvador Dali has to say about, you know, military plans. But then when you actually really dig into the subject, you realize that there is, you know, a complete logic to how it shook out like that.
Do you view camouflage as some form of art, or is it more in the realm of graphic design, or, you know, what is camouflage? How do you see it? Maybe the process of this research has changed the way you think of it before, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think before the subject, I would have just thought of it as being just like this sheer military, you know, scientific thing, like, right? I mean, and now, I mean, camouflage now is so totally, I mean, it's always the basics. It's what you're doing is you're hiding defense and you're hiding predators, right? But I think in the early conflicts of the 20th century, it was an art form. And, you know, when you're looking at the basic teachings that the surrealists were laying out in terms of showing the military about how to think about camouflage, it's not just sticking twigs in your helmet and hoping that they think you're a tree on the other side. I mean, it's like, you know, they're using all of these artistic approaches, you know, shading, counter shading, texture was a really big deal. You know, so all of a sudden these artistic approaches have very serious military currency, and it worked. So if you read my article, you can see we have a couple of examples of Roland Penrose's. He designed sniper suits, you know, suggested sniper suits. And you can see one of them translated into this tree blending sniper suit. And it's, first of all, it's incredibly beautiful. But secondly, it really does trick the eye. And so you know, that it really was an artistic approach in those early conflicts. I mean, now it's a totally different bag. I mean, everything is, it's harder to camouflage anything now, you know, in the era of, you know, let's say infrared surveillance or that kind of thing. I mean, you're not going to be able to wear, you know, an outfit that looks like a tree, but your body heat is going to, you know, show you up. So, but back then these were not just life-saving measures for soldiers on the defensive, but they were very significant tools that were used to turn the war to the Allies' advantage.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, the idea that at some point in the history, because of technology and the way mm-hmm. things change, mm-hmm. it became less of a utility and more of an aesthetic in a certain sense, right? You'll watch.
Yeah, it's less visual, right? I mean, because for the surrealist, it was all about tricking the eye, mm-hmm. the naked eye. And you know, they were really good at that. They had studied that. Through the 1930s, they had looked at how nature tricks the naked eye. They looked at natural world camouflage, you know, stick insects, leaf insects, that kind of thing. And so, but then, you know, as technology advances, it's not just about tricking the naked eye anymore, as we've discussed. So, you know, I think that there's still a lot of basics that are in play that we're talking about, but I think that, you know, technology has advanced so significantly that we're in a totally different playing field altogether. And, you know, one of the experts who I consulted for this article really felt that the Phantom Army offensive that we described in North Africa in 1942 was probably the last huge major scale visual, like a naked eye camouflage subterfuge that really worked on that level.
Yeah, it's like kind of like this military trompe l'oeil, you know, this kind of strange moment in time where that really was needed and useful and made a difference. You know, there's so many interesting characters in the piece you write about of varying levels of realistic expectations. And I'm curious, it seems like some people kind of understand what they're going for. Other people, I think, are trying to make Harry Potter's cloak of invisibility and don't understand maybe the limitations of what mm-hmm. camouflage can be. What are some of the more outlandish ideas that people thought they could actually pull off with camouflage?
Well, I mean, look, a lot of the outlandish ideas really did actually work in this instance. I mean, it's pretty crazy, right? So, you know, the battle that we're talking about, the Battle of Alamein in North Africa, I mean, it's won by sheer military force and strategy and guns and bombs, and but it's also won by palm fronds and string and, you know, miles and miles and miles of string and tarp. I mean, so it's like the idea that you would suddenly, in the middle of the desert, create 500 dummy tanks and 1500 dummy trucks and, you know, 1500 dummy soldiers. And, you know, they're imagine being a soldier in the desert and you thought that you were going out there to, you know, to shoot Germans, but you're there creating, you know, physical dummies and staging them. I mean, they're creating basically this enormous, like a Hollywood-esque set, you know, out there in the desert. And so the outlandishness, it really did come into actual play. I think, you know, one of the things that drew me initially to the topic was, you know, I thought that it was going to be really absurd and flamboyant, but it ended up being, as you know, as I said in the article, it ended up being deadly serious. I mean, I think a lot of these surrealists, no matter how much they were prone to flamboyance in their civilian lives, when they were in the position to work in military units on camouflage, they knew it was serious business and that lives were depending on their ingenuity. And so, you know, they did take it very seriously. And I think that the closer you were involved in seeing how your designs were practically applied in combat, the more effective your designs were. So again, I keep coming back now and in my story to Roland Penrose, because he did see how sniper suits were going to be used. He did see how shadow was being, you know, used. I mean, they studied aerial surveillance photographs. And so they could see how things looked from above. You know, it wasn't just about, you know, using paint to occlude things, to try to make things blend in from above. It was about using all kinds of materials to create textures on top of tanks and buildings and humans to make them blend in. So, you know, all of the things that would have seemed completely weird and outlandish ended up being really smart. And they did save a lot of lives. Not saying that there weren't little indulgences, like there, you know, there was one surrealist, Julian Trevelyan, who was put on units that helped camouflage what they called pillbox units. There are these massive concrete bunkers that are placed across, the British Isles to slow down the progress of invading tanks, if it had come to that. And Julian Trevelyan gets like really into his designs. So he'll make them into like what he called petrol stations, or there's a cafe, and he's even delicately putting, closed for the summer signs up and curtains. And I mean, so he can get a little OCD in those designs. And I got
it. He was like Wes Andersoning it.
Totally. Like he and Wes Anderson would have adored each other. And Wes needs to know about him. But I mean, so I got, and he also, I got kind of a kick out of his description of his assimilation into military life. And he's like, yeah, I tried really hard to take the uniform seriously, but it wasn't quite complete for him unless he had like a little velvet cap and a walking stick. And, so these guys, some of them never got all their absurdity drained out of them by military life. But again, the flamboyance and their unusual way of thinking was precisely what made them so effective in this respect also.
This episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Condition Reports. What the heck is a condition report, you may ask? It's pretty simple. Condition reports are a tool for artists, curators, conservators, insurance companies, appraisers, and museum professionals, as well as maybe even a few obsessive homeowners, for keeping track of the changing physical condition of a work of art. Pulling out a piece for a new show? Time for a condition report. Putting it away? Condition report time. You get the idea. They're kind of important. For one free set of monogram condition reports, please visit myconditionreports.biz and use promo code MC22.
The last thing I'd like to talk about is the kind of uniqueness of this moment. When you look at this period for World War II, which was seen for the most part, especially from the American side, as the good war, people mostly understood the endeavor, were supportive of the endeavor, taking on fascism in Europe and everywhere else. In some ways, it was one of the last examples of that. The current situation in Ukraine is in some ways a reminder of what that could feel like when it feels like you're kind of on the right side of things. But by the time we'd gotten to Vietnam, for example, artists were not wanting to participate in the military construct of that. And every kind of conflict since then, you could see that the role of like bringing in creatives, artists, probably would have been much more polarizing because of the politics of the moment or anything else. Do you kind of view this as kind of a last gasp for there to have been a potential to bring creatives into a military endeavor like this? Because it doesn't seem possible in kind of the last half of the 20th century or even now.
It's an interesting question. I've been thinking a lot about Ukraine vis-a-vis the start of World War II and the way that we're just describing. And at first I thought, it's at least right now, where we are right now, I'm like, maybe it's less the start of World War II than it's the Spanish Civil War, in terms of, seeing people, foreigners going to fight on behalf of Ukraine there. I mean, it's like, it's the cause, right? I mean, like how the last time you really did see this pure, unadulterated, unprovoked evil was the beginning of World War II, but also the shot across the bow with the Spanish Civil War. People perceived it that way also. And that also, that conflict was like the starter conflict and really attracted a ton of creatives to go and work there. And, a lot of them, a few of the surrealists who ended up working in World War II had first seen camouflage in the Spanish Civil War. It's hard to say a blanket statement, but I feel pretty safe in saying that in subsequent conflicts after World War II, you're seeing creatives mostly documenting subsequent wars, either in a documentary way or after the fact in artistic ways and not necessarily in the most flattering way. Again, I keep coming back to, for the surrealists, and in particular, the surrealists who I'm documenting, Roland Penrose, Lee Miller, Julian Trevelyan, they really were under direct existential threat by Hitler's forces. Their houses were being bombed. Their countrymen were being slaughtered in London. I mean, at the time the surrealists founded their first camouflage unit, Winston Churchill had just given his famous fight on the beaches speech. Everybody expected to be invaded and massacred. So it wasn't just like this artistic heart swelling, like let's go fight the good fight. It was like, if we don't do this, we're going to die. And if we don't do the best job that we can do with our skills, other people are going to die also. But I think, in terms of the feeling of unadulterated righteousness in the cause, I feel like that's definitely still specific to World War II until probably now, what we're seeing now in Ukraine. I mean, I think that it's, and it's definitely not something that, that people were feeling during, say, Vietnam or Korea or Iraq.
In January 1943, with Italy still under Mussolini's fascist rule, Michelangelo's David and accompanying statues were encased in protective shells in Florence to shield them from falling Allied bombs as the war moved through the region. At 14 feet tall and weighing in at over 6 tons, David specifically was far too massive to be easily transported. David made it through the war unscathed, safe in his brick hive. But nearly 50 years later, in 1991, a vandal with a hammer hacked off one of his giant marble toes. Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.